Hey there and welcome. Another episode here of Irreplaceable Truths, I'm Dr. G. We love just to sit down and just talk about the profession. We want to bring what we've learned the hard way so you don't need to. Today I'm with Dr. Sarah. Welcome, Dr. Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So let's get into a little history about you.
Okay.
So I know you're a 2011 grad.
Yes.
What school did you attend?
Tuskegee University in
Tuskegee.
Alabama.
Tuskegee!
Yes.
You're the first Tuskegee grad I've ever got a chance to sit down and talk
awesome.
To. How was it?
It was really good. It was a very good experience for me. It was different being from LA and going to Alabama, but the connections I made at that university, I still talk to my classmates. They came to my wedding. I see them at conferences. So it was such a wonderful small class, and it was an amazing experience there.
What was their class size?
Gosh, I want to say it was in the 70s.
Oh, so it was old school.
Yeah.
Yeah, my class was, I think we started out 85, yeah. Graduated 71.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
Oh, wow. How many schools did you apply to?
Probably, I'm thinking maybe 8 schools.
Eight. Wow. I think I applied to every single one.
Yeah.
You know, Wisconsin was very nice to tell me I was 1,146 on the wait list. You know,
yeah.
It's like, really?
Yeah.
You tell me there's a chance. That's a good thing to hear. Yeah. But Tuskegee's, wow, man. Yeah. You know, I never have gotten a chance to visit that school.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine it looks, did you get a chance to go to Mississippi State or Auburn while you were there?
I was able to go to Auburn.
Yeah, that's a beautiful campus, too.
It is.
That vet school?
It is.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
When I was an undergrad in North Carolina, I visited NC State. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I could just imagine the school is amazing. What's the population around the school?
Very low. I mean, there's not a lot of people in Tuskegee, the surrounding areas. I lived in Auburn. I needed to have a Walmart near me, so I needed to have some kind of shopping, and it was just a little bit in the middle of nowhere.
It was.
Yeah.
And you were the only specialist, quote-unquote specialist, for serving the area then?
Correct. Yeah.
And what were their options to go? Was it Auburn or Tuskegee?
Auburn or Tuskegee were and they're about 20 minutes away from each other, so they're pretty close.
Oh, that is very
yeah.
close. I didn't realize it was that close. I need to learn my geography a little bit better of Alabama. So you leave LA and you go to Alabama.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with this hard landing, right? Culturally and also academically.
Yeah.
Where was your undergrad?
Loyola Marymount.
LMU.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Great school. Beautiful school.
Beautiful campus. Very different.
Right. For those of you who don't know, if you land in LAX, if you look to the right, that's LMU.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous campus.
Yeah.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah.
That is a difference, right? Undergrad to grad school.
I remember one of my memories going to Tuskegee was there was a Piggly Wiggly, and I went there, and someone had rode on his horse, tied up the horse, went grocery shopping. I saw tumbleweeds, and I thought, I'm in a movie. Like, this is so different than what I was used to, and this is where I'm going to be for the next 4 years, so I'm going to learn to embrace it.
But the beautiful thing about Tuskegee is it did not take you, you know, 2 hours to go 4 miles.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, so... Did they have clinics at Tuskegee?
We did. We started junior clinics.
Junior clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically just referrals from?
Correct.
From local practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So now, okay, so you're at Tuskegee. You meet your classmates. Diverse group at Tuskegee?
Very diverse group.
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Love that.
And I love that. Coming from Los Angeles, and it was something I was very used to, and diversity made us learn from each other. So I loved it.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand about diversity is that you get a lot of phenomenal ideas from
Absolutely.
Different walks of life
mm-hmm.
and how they can work together. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So so many questions though.
Okay.
Did you work at a veterinary clinic before you went?
I did. She was actually a graduate of Tuskegee, which is why I applied. She had so many wonderful things to say about the school. And I worked for her, I actually volunteered. I was never a technician there, but for, I wanna say almost 2 years, I volunteered at the hospital. And so I had a little different perspective than some people who were coming into school, who were technicians for years, who had a lot more experience. And so it was a shift for me. It was a change.
It was a change. Mm-hmm. How many hours do you think you volunteered, if you were to guess?
Gosh, maybe I did like Saturdays and Sundays when I was an undergrad at the time, and probably a few hours each week. So, gosh, maybe 1,000.
1,000 hours.
Give or take.
Okay, good. Yeah. We'll get back to that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's phenomenal. So at least, and then where you were, at least as a volunteer, you could get some hands-on experience.
Correct.
Because most of the time, as you well know now, as being a veterinarian, when you have volunteers, very rarely do we let the volunteers touch, right? Especially in California, mm-hmm. because forget the medical board, insurance.
Yeah.
Right? If something happens to a volunteer, not only do you get a gut punch,
right,
but you could also get a lawsuit.
Correct.
And that's unfortunate that it's such a litigious state out here that there's a lot holding back, because in Alabama, sure. I'm pretty sure volunteers are like thrown into the mix immediately.
Yeah.
Whoa, you ever handled a horse? No, good. Let's go collect this stallion.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's a little different. definitely different, right. You know, where you are in the country.
Yeah.
How was your first year of vet school?
It was hard. I had good grades, but I was not a 4.0 student. So I had to work really hard, and I felt like I had to work twice as hard in order to catch up with everybody. And I didn't know this at the time, but I suffered from imposter syndrome in vet school and even graduating and first practicing. So I felt like, wow, why am I here? Am I as good as any of these other people, as my classmates? You know, why am I not performing as well here? I got pretty good grades in undergrad, and I'm struggling. I had to shift the way I studied. So the way I studied in undergrad was very different than how I had to learn to study in veterinary school. And so there were so many different factors. And the first semester was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah. Semester system, right? Not trimester.
Yes.
So how many hours, credit hours, 20, 22?
I think it was about 22.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then people don't realize that. I mean, everyone's like, well, are you serious? I'm like, yeah, 22, 25, 26.
Yeah.
Like a full-time student's 12, right. 13. You're mm-hmm. doubling that in a semester.
Yeah.
You're like a double full-time student. Mm-hmm. And another thing that a lot of people don't realize when you go to school, the only people who are going to understand the hell you're going through are those who are in it or
exactly.
been through it.
Exactly.
So if you go with a significant other or a husband mm-hmm. or a wife or a partner or whatever, they're going to have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
Nor do they care to hear.
Right.
So you really have to rely on your cohort of students. Mm-hmm. So immediately, did you get that group of like 5, 6?
For sure.
Right.
For sure. Bonded very well. And then even further, when we had clinics together and you had your clinic group, that was our core group of people that we were with even more than, you know, family at home.
Yeah.
So
going through vet school, did you make any good relationships with the professors?
I did. The professor, because they were such small class sizes, they knew who you were. They knew if you weren't in class that day, they knew exactly what was going on. So you couldn't just blend into the background. Everyone knew your name.
The professors at Tuskegee, were they professional academians, or did they come from practice?
A lot of them were just clinicians, but they did have some that were in regular practice as well. So yeah. It was a mix.
I think that's one of the issues with veterinary school is that a lot of the professors are amazing,
mm-hmm.
but they haven't been in the quote-unquote real world.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the arguments that people make, is that are we setting these students up to fail, because mm-hmm. they're being taught an incredible technical education.
Right.
But the whole soft side isn't there.
Yeah.
How was your soft side taught at Tuskegee? Communication, breaking bad news.
We had
emotional labor.
Probably one semester of client communication, which I don't think was enough. As clinicians, we were in charge of the cases, but there was always, you know, someone else who was overseeing things. So we dealt with circumstances where, okay, here's a scenario. If this happens, let's role play it out. What are you going to say? And I think it helped. I just wanted more of that. I wish we had some more.
And it's like surgery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you sit in a surgery lecture, all the pictures are beautiful,
yeah.
Right?
You're
like,
they're, so you get in there
like,
and do
like,
it.
Oh, we're doing this splenectomy. There's not a drop of blood. Yeah. It's the cleanest incision you've ever seen. Yeah. All their robes are blue. You know, their gloves are perfect. And it's like, I could, until you do a splenectomy, and then you're like, holy shit, there's blood everywhere.
Yeah.
This animal's going to die. I'm going to die. What's going on?
Yeah.
So I look at communication kind of the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can have all the communication classes, but until you sit down and have that horrible conversation of, you know, quality of life, cost of care, or even, hey, this didn't go right. There, something went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, those types of conversations.
Yeah.
I don't think schools are preparing for that. And in my dissertation, that's my biggest argument, is that I think one of the biggest arguments I make is that they do not teach enough emotional intelligence in schools, and they select on IQ, not EQ.
Yeah.
Right?
I totally agree.
Yeah. And so let me ask you, what got you into the drive to become a veterinary professional?
You know, I have two sides to me. I have my creative side. I love art, poetry, very creative person. But then I also have the side of me that's a science nerd. So it was figuring out which one's going to win out. And as a child, I was just always drawn to animals. My mom would tell me stories about how her neighbor had this German shepherd, and I was maybe 3 years old at the time. I would go to her, try to open her mouth, see what's inside. I was always attracted to animals.
How old were you?
3 years old. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm just thinking of oh my gosh. And no problem, right? No bites, no growls.
No, this dog let me do whatever to her.
That, you're lucky.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It wasn't a chihuahua.
Right. But I felt that, and I was always the person at parties. I'm petting the cat, you know. I always just felt drawn to them, drawn to their energy.
Do you think that's enough to get drawn into the profession?
I don't think so. I think you need the passion, you need the drive. I think the more I started volunteering, I started seeing more of the bond between the human-animal bond. The more it made me see, this is really important work. I would love to be a part of something grand like this.
Yeah, because, I mean, many veterinarians say that it's the human-animal bond that really draws them in. But that's also a major source of emotional drain.
Sure.
Emotional exhaustion.
Sure.
Right? What tips did you learn to balance that?
So I think naturally I'm a very anxious person. Probably my baseline anxiety is a little higher than most people. And I had to learn to separate the veterinary side from my personal side a little bit. And I'm naturally a very introverted person. So the energy I get is from being in my own space, doing my own thing. Being at the clinic is so different because I have to take control of the exam room. I'm talking to different clients with different personalities. I'm leading, you know, leading the staff, making these decisions. So to me, it was a lot to just be at work. It was draining in that way. So I had to learn to say, I'm going to deal with what I can and do my best at work. And if that client decided that they couldn't get that treatment done for their pet and I felt terrible, or if something happened that I could have handled that better, maybe I shouldn't have done another test, you know, all these things that you think about. There were cases they would keep me up at night. You know, I would have a hard time sleeping, or if one of my patients went to the ER, I was the one calling the ER at 9 or 10 o'clock at night to check in on the patient, seeing how it was doing. There's things that eat away at you. And I think you have to learn to let go and say, I did my best with the information that I had at the time. My intention behind it was really good, and I'm going to let that go. And I can't let that eat away into the rest of my day, into the rest of my life.
Being an introvert, which I'm the exact opposite. On the Myers-Briggs, the highest score you could get for extroversion was a 30, and I was a 30. The hardest part about being an introvert is that it takes a lot of energy to be extroverted.
Right.
Did you find that as a cause of exhaustion at the end of the day?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I wanted to come home. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to do anything. I was talking to people all day, and so I just wanted to be left alone, maybe watch a mind-numbing TV show or just be able to relax, read a book. I just really didn't want to be a part, have a social life after that. Like, it took a lot for me to get out there.
Yeah, you know, that's part of the recovery, though, from a day of work is actually having the energy to do your art, do your creative stuff, go out to dinner with your partner, you know, hang out socially with people. Yeah. And you didn't have that, did you?
Not so much at the beginning.
How long did it take you to balance the highs and lows of the profession?
Gosh, it took me years. One of the things I learned about myself, maybe 6 years into practicing, is that I became very anxious for surgery. And when I first graduated, I loved doing surgery. I was doing enucleations, gastrotomies, like I was all about surgery. And nothing terrible happened. I didn't have like a bad experience. None of my patients died. Like there wasn't anything traumatic that happened. But I just started getting more and more anxious about the surgeries I had the next day. I couldn't fall asleep at night. I took double the amount of time I normally would to do a spay. I mean, there was just all these things that started, you know, bothering me about it. And so I had talked to my boss at the time and I said, look, this is what's happening with me right now. I don't really know why. I don't really know how to explain it, but I'm much happier not being in surgery. And so he said, great, then I love it. I'll do more surgeries and you just focus on seeing patients and internal medicine, which I really loved. And so I don't think it was until I found that balance of saying, this is what I need, this is what works the best for me, that I was really able to tap into. I need to, one, be able to speak up and say, this is how I'm feeling, this is what I think I need, let's try this out. And also a little bit of experience and time seeing cases and feeling comfortable. You just, sounds cliche to say it, but you just don't know until you go through something. You don't know until you're really having those hard conversations with people in real life, how it's going to be and how it's going to affect you emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I often feel as if our profession's romanticized. Yet it's probably one of the most stressful professions you can be in.
Yes.
I always compare veterinary medicine to nursing, right? Because you're intimately involved in your case, the family, like the communication, everything. It's all on you, right? And unlike what I've always been asked, why I didn't become a real doctor, an MD?
Yeah.
I mean, MDs are in and out. If you're in the hospital, they're in and out of your room in what? 10 minutes, maybe. Hey, incision looks good. I'm going to send you home tomorrow. She's going to give you pain meds. If you have any questions, ask your nurse.
Yeah.
That's always what happens, right? Where with our profession, it's like completely all the time. You know, this is what, you know, you're in it. You're in it so deep. What are some of the biggest stressors you or your classmates you still are in contact with have had to deal with, in your opinion?
The emotional toll is a big one, whether that's compassion fatigue, you know, seeing pets that are suffering, being able to have the difficult conversations with someone about, you know, this pet, we really need to consider humane euthanasia, going through euthanasias. I mean, all those take a little bit of you every time it happens. Staffing, too, and clinic dynamics. I think a lot of technicians are leaving the industry. Veterinarians are leaving the industry. There's a lot that's going on where people are like, I don't have to do this. I don't have to put up with this. And so they'll leave. And so that's become a struggle. The high costs now of pet care, more people are owning pets now. There's, in some ways, some clients have these unrealistic expectations of what we can do and what we can do with their budget and what the pet's in for that day. So all of that together, I think has compounded into making things a little bit harder in vet med in general.
And the reason why I asked about the stressors is there's tons of research that stress and anxiety go hand in hand. Do you think, you said your anxiety was taken off. Do you think your stress was also taken off at the same time?
For sure.
It was.
For sure.
It was. Because you were getting more cases, because you were getting a bigger client following.
Yeah, seeing a lot of sick patients a day, you know, feeling overwhelmed, feeling like I am never able to catch up, going home, having to do notes. I mean, all of that takes a toll on me. And it was like a feedback loop, right, with the stress and anxiety, and it just would,
and
they would feed on each
other.
And
poor recovery when you got home because you just wanted to sit down and be by yourself in a cave.
Yeah.
Yeah, you introverts, I never understand you. I never understand you. So, I mean, because, well, when we talk about, like, one of my biggest issues I had when corporate took us over was that the regional manager had the gall to say, I can't believe you guys close at 6. Do you know how many people have jobs and they can't come in until after 6? My first response to her was, is what I'm doing not a job? Right? So you sound like you had a good mentor, though, at your practice.
I did.
Was that the only practice you ever worked at full time?
No, I briefly went to a different practice. It was not a good fit. I thought I would grow more. So I went back. He was a private practitioner in the LA area. I was with him for over 10 years. And then in Chicago, when I moved to Chicago, there was a private practice that I was on board for a couple of years while I was there.
Yeah. I wish I would have known you then because I could have told you where to go because being an Illinois grad.
Awesome.
I got all my classmates in the Chicago area and all the suburbs. Yeah, I was blessed with a wonderful class just like you were. Love every single one of my classmates still.
Yeah.
They're absolutely amazing. But the crazy thing is I think maybe only 20 of us are still practicing.
Yeah.
Because the emotional toll is real. You know, and I wish there was a secret sauce to tell people this is how you do it.
And then
that's the point I have with these conversations is I want to have crucial conversations about things that people learned because there's not one recipe that will work for everybody.
Right.
It's like, kind of like parenting in a way, right? So have you ever got a chance to mentor any of the younger students coming out?
In a way, I wasn't a direct mentor, but, you know, seeing anyone in the clinic who is new, I always try to share what's going on with the case, you know, things that have worked for me, and maybe this will work for you. You'll have to see. Here's the kind of conversations I have with the owner. This is my spiel. You can, you know, make it your own, whatever works for you. So I had the chance to do that a little bit, just not as much as I would like. And now I've been doing relief, and so I don't really get that exposure anymore.
So, and the reason why I was asking you, because anxiety is a problem in the population of the world in general. And I'm hoping someone out there with anxiety will listen to this question. With a when your anxiety is built up, how did you prepare yourself to have that stressful discussion, whether it's quality of life, something didn't go right, cost of care with a client? How did you prep yourself for that?
You know, sometimes what I needed to do was take a moment, go into the office, take some deep breaths, maybe practice what I was going to say, and then also just know that, okay, I'm going into this with the best of intentions. This is a shitty situation, and we're going to do what we can, and I'm here for you, and what questions do you have?
Shitty is a medical term, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, some, I mean, and you can't spin everything in a positive way. You know, I always say you know, gratitude is a big part of, and shifting my mentality has been a big part of managing my anxiety in general, but there are situations that you just can't do that with. And so it's just an experience that you're going to learn from. You know, when you're having a difficult situation with a client, nothing anyone can say or do is going to make that any easier, and you're just going to have to go for it head on. But taking some moments, closing my eyes, taking some deep breaths, practicing some breathing and just letting go before I did that was for sure very helpful.
And you don't have to answer this, but did you have a therapist when you're in?
I did. So I had one in veterinary school. I mean, I still
provided
have.
By school?
No. Oh. I did it on my own.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you still have one?
Still have one now. Yeah. Wow. I think it's when I don't do therapy, I feel more anxious, and going once, twice a month, it really helps me unload my feelings. It helps me process them better. And it helps me bring my expectations down for myself. I think I'm very, very hard on myself. And that was probably why I had imposter syndrome a little bit. And there's a sense of perfectionism and just, okay, I'm a vet now. I should know everything. And I didn't understand that I'm not a completed project. I mean, it's practicing medicine. You have to get out there. It's something that you're going to get better at each day. And I'm still learning, and I learn better ways to do things and say things and than I did 10 years ago. That's just how it is.
Learn ways to do things more efficiently.
Correct.
Learn ways to use your staff more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Learn how to talk better on the phone. Yeah. Learn the beauty of email and mm-hmm. texting.
Mm-hmm.
Learn the importance of letting a client know immediately when their animal's out of surgery.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things. And whoever, yeah, there's a lot of, there, I was going to go this route, but I decided not to. The concept of being a perfectionist, right? Because in order to get into undergrad, especially in California, LMU, you had to be perfect almost in high school.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get into vet school, because of the way they're accepting, you have to be perfect in undergrad.
Yeah.
Once you graduate, you think, oh my God, I still got to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to learn to let go of that.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to break that cycle.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was very lucky. I graduated high school with a 2.6. And if it wasn't for swimming, I wouldn't have gotten into a single school. But I did. I got into many schools because mm-hmm. of swimming. And I didn't realize until I got into college that, hey, I'm not going to be a professional swimmer. So my perfectionism really didn't start until college. So I had a few years buffer. Like, I didn't take AP classes. I didn't do any of that stuff. And I think that helped me. I think the whole concept of being perfect, unfortunately, is just ingrained in us now, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's Hollywood, social media, you name it. It's unfortunate. And it's okay. It's actually cool to not be perfect.
Yeah.
Because what attracts me to people are their characters, mm-hmm. right? Like, you make me laugh, you do stupid things, I'm going to give you crap for it, but I'm still going to help you,
yeah.
right? And I wonder if our clients come in thinking that we are supposed to be perfect,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You really want to turn the conversation on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't.
Yeah.
You can't, because there are certain expectations that are put on you as being the doctor that you can't act in certain ways.
Yeah.
Like, there's many times I've wanted to go on, like, Reddit, Yelp, Google, respond to podcasts, what people are saying.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my veterinarian's a crook. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Someone said that to me. So I knew I couldn't do anything, so I called my attorney. I said, hey, will you take care of this for me? And they did, because it's illegal to call someone a crook.
Yeah.
But, I mean, unfortunately, that's where... Because of cost or care is where it's at, and what's going on in our profession, we've almost set us up for this.
Yeah.
And the problem is veterinary medicine, do you agree or disagree? It's slow to change.
I agree that it's slow to change. I think a lot of mentality is, well, this is how we've always done it, and it's worked for us so far. And it takes a lot to change, and there's growing pains with change. So people don't want to do it, right? The devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. It's so much easier to deal with, okay, here's how we've been doing things, and it may not be perfect, but that's how we're going to go along. And I think that's unfortunate. But I think there's a mindset like that in a lot of clinics around the country.
Yeah, there is, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, trying to get my practice to go to paperless records back in 2007, 2008. You thought I was trying to like split the hydrogen atom,
yeah.
You know? But all of a sudden, as soon as they saw the change, they're like, oh, this is so much better.
Yeah.
You know, that's how we actually got through the Great Recession, is we went paperless,
mm-hmm.
and we automatically picked up the 25% of mischarges you have if you have a written record. So we broke even.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be ready to pivot.
Right.
And this profession does not pivot.
Yeah.
It's almost like the definition of insanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, what's going on in the profession? Oh, we're losing everybody.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, hey, maybe we should change the way we're accepting kids into school and what the type of person we're looking for, their answer is, let's open up more vet schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's like, come on, seriously?
Yeah. And how are we training those veterinary students? I mean, can we have more veterinary business classes? Can we have more on client communication? Can we, you know, we just didn't have that as much. When I went, like, it was very limited, and I felt like I didn't know what to expect if I wanted to own my own practice. I didn't know how to balance a budget where, you know, you had to deal with a veterinary clinic. There was all these things that I felt like you needed to learn on your own that they just didn't have. And I think there's so much we can do with training vets.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. The thing is, I always tell, like, at least the pre-veterinary students, take a couple business classes.
Mm-hmm.
At least learn what a P&L is, learn what stuff is. I mean, our business class at Illinois was 4 hours on a Saturday, and it was all about your contract.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what, your contract's just such a small part
of
everything.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to stay where you started, ever.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few that do,
mm-hmm.
right? But a great majority, you're going to keep switching.
Yeah.
So... you're a big advocate for preventative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
How do you use preventative medicine on yourself for your mental health and your anxiety?
It's recognizing what I need. So for me, that's making sure I take the time to do yoga. It's making sure I'm practicing mindfulness, whether that's meditation, bird watching, journaling. Those are things that I know have worked for me in the past. And when stress hits me, those things tend to be what drop off, and that's not good. So I need to keep going back to it and keep reminding myself, no, this is what you need to make time for, and these things are super important. Everything else doesn't mean everything else isn't, but you really need to make those things a priority.
And then you were in regular general practice for how long? How many years?
So I did GP up until 2022.
So 11 years.
Yeah, and then I did relief after that, and I'm doing relief now.
Okay, 11 years in.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel burnout creeping in?
Oh, for sure.
What were you feeling?
Exhaustion. Just coming home, not having the energy for anything else. Feeling like my life was veterinary medicine. I couldn't really have a life outside of that. And honestly, it was what pushed me into relief. I mean, there were circumstances in my life that also aligned, but I came to the point where if you would have asked me then, hey, would you do this again? Would you be a vet again? I'd say no. I would have not chosen this path. I would have done something else. What it takes of you emotionally, mentally, physically is a lot. And I still question it from time to time, to be very transparent, very honest. But having relief, I am able to adjust my schedule more, and I'm able to work as much or as little as I want, to be able to have time for myself. I don't have to ask for PTO. I make my own PTO. I can dictate how I practice. I'm going to, practice fear-free. The days of holding down dogs and cats to do treatments is over. Like, I'm not going to do that. There's things that I'm able to say with whatever clinic I'm at that makes me feel like I'm more in control of the situation.
Do you put that in your contract?
I do.
Mm-hmm. So did you make up your own contract?
I did.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, everyone who complains about that, guess what? Veterinary medicine, you were slow to change. You set yourself up for this.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened. Everything that happens in my opinion, mm-hmm. in this profession that people call quote unquote bad is because we did not make a pivot.
Mm-hmm.
We did not make a pivot.
Yeah.
So if your number one value in life is work-life balance,
mm-hmm.
are veterinary clinics the way to go?
Truthfully, no. I think there's a lot that you have to advocate for yourself to make sure that it is.
Do you think you're ready for just relief work 6 months out?
Do you mean just like that's what I'm going to do? I think so. I've done it the past couple of years.
But you had 11 years of experience before you went
right,
into relief.
Right.
Do you think you were ready 6 months out?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Would you think you were ready a year out?
No, I think you need, if we're just trying to put a number on it, at least 5 or 8 years of experience. I mean, you need to be able to feel comfortable working on your own. You need to feel comfortable with different cases and situations. I see people who do relief at other clinics who are new graduates, which just blows my mind because I just feel like that's not ideal.
You're setting your own self up for a lot of
Correct.
Problems. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
you need that mentorship.
Did you do an internship or residency?
I didn't. I went straight to private practice.
And that's always my argument, too, is that you don't need to do that internship or residency. Don't get me wrong. We need specialists.
Mm-hmm.
We need specialists. I'll repeat that 1,000 times. But if you're going to go into GP and you have someone who's willing to take you under your wing
mm-hmm.
and create that friendship bond, mm-hmm. that fatherly, motherly figure bond, always available and teach you the ropes and also introduce you to everybody.
Right.
You're going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were lucky.
I was.
Yeah. It scares the absolute crap out of me when I see some of these relief doctors that are doing it. They're like, oh yeah, I'm 6 months out. I'm doing relief. Yeah. I hate veterinary medicine. I'm like, you never gave it a chance.
Yeah.
You had Dr. Peter Weinstein.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
He's written out almost every single veterinary economic book there is. Mm-hmm. He was the president of the FCVMA. He's won every award possible in veterinary medicine. I'm blessed enough to have him on my advisory committee. And we had a meeting for my dissertation. And he said it perfectly. He's like, you're flying through very turbulent air through vet school. And when you come out of vet school, are you going to have a hard landing? Or you're going to have a soft landing. And that's going to dictate the rest of your career. And if you feel like you're coming out of vet school and you have a hard landing, you're in the wrong clinic.
Right. Totally.
Period.
Agree. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I want to make sure that everyone understands. You do not need to stay where you are. If you believe that you cannot be your true, authentic self in your job,
mm-hmm.
find somewhere else.
Right.
But don't go to relief immediately because, especially in this state,
mm-hmm.
one mistake,
mm-hmm.
you're in deep dog doo-doo.
Yeah.
Do you think your anxiety came in the way of you feeling comfortable? It took you a little longer? I mean, like, I find it interesting because I love, and I hate to harp on the anxiety piece, but the anxiety piece to me, did that cause more of your imposter syndrome? Did it cause you to believe that you weren't ready sooner?
For sure. I mean, I think that it went hand in hand. I didn't do a good job of controlling it, especially early on. And so I think all of that compounded together was a recipe for disaster. And it took me many years. And I didn't even know there was a word for that. I didn't know there was something called imposter syndrome till years down the line. I was like, oh, that was me. And now there's a lot more resources. There's mentor vet. There's not one more vet. There's a lot of different ways that you can express it, which I didn't know.
Ready Vet Go is another one. Mm-hmm. I love Ready Vet Go too. Mm. I had mentor vet on the show already. I had Ready Vet Go. And one of the things I'm doing for my dissertation is that instead of giving a fee to the people that do apply, you know, to fill out my surveys, I'm going to make a donation to mm-hmm. Not One More Vet at the end for everyone that fills out everything I needed.
That's wonderful.
Because I don't think our clients even, the one thing I did in my, I love it. One of my new associates taught me this. Like you said, you're always learning. If a client is giving you a lot of grief, send them an email with the link to Not One More Vet.
Mm.
Ask them to make a donation.
Mm-hmm.
That will shut them up in a second.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I've learned since I started this podcast and releasing all this content is no one realized how bad this profession is getting because of their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's sad too, because I love veterinary medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can never get me out of it. I mean, once I was a veterinarian, I'm a veterinarian. Like, there's so much I could do, but I couldn't do clinics anymore. And so that's why another thing is, like, if you're having a trouble in clinics, there are so many other things you can do as a veterinarian.
Right.
Go teach, right? Give back. Do you feel, if you're looking for fulfillment, figure out what your why is and go there. So what do you think your why is now?
I think being able to see the bond through relief, it's different than what I thought it would be. When I was in general practice, you grow with the owners. Like, you see them come back year after year, their families. Yeah, you develop that relationship. I don't get that anymore with relief, but I get a different sort of every single patient that I see. I still see that bond. That's a reminder of why I got into this in the first place. I've experienced it firsthand. I know how special it is. I know these are members of our families. And I want to be able to say, I made a little bit of a difference in that pet's life, in that person's life. And that's what keeps drawing me back into it.
And you're going to get me to start crying, because the one thing that I miss the most, when I left December 31st, 23, I remember looking at every patient that last week saying, I don't fucking trust another veterinarian to take care of you. And it still hits me today. I was on my third generation of client, you know, and I can't express how much my clients meant to me. And that's maybe why I love GP so much, because I am extroverted. So, you know, the 10-minute appointment, 15-minute appointment would be 45 minutes, because we're talking about football, or we're talking about, heaven forbid, politics, or we're talking about family stuff, or how my kids are, or how their kids are, or, you know, a young couple that just got married, got their first dog, you know, their fur baby, which is a red flag if someone calls it a fur baby. But I miss that interaction more than anything. And I don't think I could get that with relief. You know?
You don't. You get it in a different way. You see it in glimpses of, you know, what you're seeing for that patient in that moment. And it's something that I do miss, you know, that the long-term relationship that you build is something that I do miss, but it's just in a different way I'm able to experience it.
The problem I have with relief, because I look at all the ads, is you just cannot tell which practices anymore are corporately owned or individually owned.
Yeah.
And I will never in my freaking life walk into a corporate-owned practice again. I will never do that. And so, you know, you get all the ads like, SOS, we need somebody, Banfield. You couldn't pay me enough to go into a Banfield.
Yeah.
And I nothing against Banfield, but I just, the whole idea of that is, I think, they're doing the one thing I could never stand, is taking advantage of the human-animal bond.
Mm.
Have you, do you see that in practice as a relief? Do you see, but like practices where you're like, they're really taking advantage of this person?
I think in practices that I've been where they focus on bottom line and come in and raise prices to the point where people are not doing blood work anymore. They can't afford to do blood work. It's $400 or $500 in some of these places. It's a lot. And in general, veterinary medicine has shifted, and we have so many specialties now, and there are different levels and different options. Like, you don't always have to go for the gold standard, but it makes it harder for people to be able to do treatments. I see it in certain clinics that, and most of them I won't go back to anymore. You know, I've learned the hard way to not book a bunch of days with a clinic, because I'm stuck going there. Instead, I'll do one or two days to see how that goes, and then see, hey, is this even a good fit for me? Are these the values that I want to put out there as a representation of me? Because it is.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the one thing I hated. I would look at a record, and I would be, why the heck did they do this?
Mm-hmm.
What was the reason for this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did they ever call you about this? They're like, oh no, I never got that result. Mm-hmm. Oh, you didn't get the result that your dog had a 458 blood sugar?
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's peeing all over the place and drinking and losing weight and probably can't stand on his back legs right now. But I mean, there are people, integrity is everything to me. Mm-hmm. That's my number one value.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. Oh, everyone always asks me my biggest values, and I would say it's either family or integrity,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to do the right thing even when no one's watching? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? I'm the type of guy that if my dog takes a poop on someone's lawn and I'm out of poop bags, I go back and pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
Just because. But, you know, there's a lot of people that don't think that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're like, I'm grinding, I need to make my money, and I need to move on.
Yeah.
And and if you feel like, again, you're at a practice that's like that,
mm-hmm.
you're at the wrong practice.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not going to throw them on, I don't mean to throw them on the bus, but that's the way corporate is.
Yeah.
And the problem is corporate throws so much money to these new grads, right? Mm-hmm. They throw so much money their way
mm-hmm.
that it's hard to say no, right? You leave school, 200,
a lot
300K in debt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're like, I got to make this money back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thrown into situations that no one should be thrown into.
Right.
Even someone with 20 years of experience, you know? But it's hard. And it, like I said, we're trying to get the word out. But, you know, everyone's going to choose their own path. And mm-hmm. I hope they don't. I hope everyone finds the love and the passion for this profession.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you got home, so you love, I want your creative side.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use that to recover?
Absolutely.
What's your favorite creative that you love?
Gosh, I would say I love reading poetry, watercolors, and bird watching. That would be my
bird
top
watching.
Three, bird watching.
Okay, so just so you know, I'm a huge Shark Tank fan because I'm an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this bird, they actually have this bird nest
uh-huh.
that you put out in the spring. And the battery in this bird nest lasts for a year. But there's a camera inside.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen them.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Yes. Are you addicted to the Eagles and Big Bear? Do you watch
them? Oh, I watch them all the time.
Yeah.
I have it on.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many cool things.
Yeah.
I mean, animals bring such a blessing to people's lives.
It's such a joy.
I mean, talking about the human-animal bond, just to sit there and watch a widower with her pet, you know that at least they have a companion.
Right.
There is a dog that they have to take out and walk.
Mm-hmm.
It gets them, when they go out and walk, they're social.
Yeah.
With kids growing up, you can tell which kids have grown up with pets and which haven't,
mm-hmm.
right? They're usually the ones that show empathy.
Yeah.
And yeah. It, you know, they know, oh, I really would love to go and be gone all day, but I can't because I gotta go. Well, with us, we had a pig. Our girls knew they had to go feed waffles at 3 o'clock, you know. That bond is one of the biggest highlights of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it personally in my own family. Yeah. I've seen it through thousands of clients.
Yeah.
I think if they taught more about the human animal bond in school, that is an emotional intelligence piece that could be a huge thing for these students.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, unfortunately, your professors, just like mine, were professional academians, right? Mm-hmm. Researchers.
Yeah.
And they're the ones teaching us. So they don't understand the human-animal bond mm-hmm. as well as those in the front lines.
Yeah.
I think specialists understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even the specialists know a million times more, in my opinion. And I'm not saying these professors at school are bad, because they're brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But they're brilliant at what they do.
Right.
Right? It's like listening to a general that's never been to the field of battle.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what these corporates are, right? They're a bunch of MBAs, a bunch of people who know how to run a spreadsheet, a bunch of people that, you know, financially they're whizzes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They could turn a penny into $1,000 in a month, right? But there's also, but they don't know what it's like to be in a clinic because they've never worked in a clinic.
Right.
Your relief, is it mostly corporate or is it private?
It's a mix. It's a mix. I always prioritize private because in my mind, I want to make sure that private practitioner is able to go on vacation, you know, they have something planned, make sure that they know their clinic's in good hands. Corporates will always find somebody. I don't always feel as obligated to go there.
Well, corporates will find somebody because they pay four times as much.
Yeah.
At least in the ads I see.
Yeah.
Because they're also the ones that are sending out the SOS
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah.
You know, when you do your relief, do they put expectations on you?
A little bit, but I only have so much control over the schedule. You know, if I go in and there's a couple of pets on the schedule, that's not on me. You know, I'm going in there, I'm doing the best that I can with each case. I'm making sure we're doing, you know, a full workup and making sure the clients don't have any questions. And what else can I do? Can I report some labs? Like, what is it that I can do to help you today? And I have my contract, which says, you know, certain things, like if a pet's going to be too aggressive or they're too anxious, I'm going to send them home with trazodone and gabapentin, and they're going to come back. I just think that's a better way of practicing medicine.
See, I haven't gotten that trazodone gabapentin to work because I'm under the belief that, you know, if these dogs have anxiety and you give them anti-anxiety meds, you get the opposite effect most of the time.
I feel like I use higher doses, and it depends on what they're coming in for, what it is. I've also started using Boncat for cats. I really like it.
Do you think there's enough trazodone for a chihuahua? Seriously?
Probably not.
Because it's so funny because out of all the breeds, I've had two chihuahuas. They were the greatest dogs mm-hmm. ever. But I did a lot of research on chihuahuas. You know, they come as a coyote from the coyote family.
Yeah.
And you either have the sweetest, most lovable, like in your face, everyone's face all the time. Or the Lancer.
They're trying to kill you, yeah.
I mean, thank goodness they're only like 4 pounds. They could do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
But those teeth can still pierce like a needle.
Yeah.
How many times have you been bit?
Gosh, probably 3 times.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never got bit.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I had an amazing staff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very vocal. They're like, let him go. Mm-hmm. Okay. I am too. I'm walking away.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. You know, the fear-free thing is, you know, obviously 3 years old now, 4 years old.
Yeah. It's been around for a while.
Yeah. The funny thing about fear-free that I have is that they're like, it's like aha, right? Mm-hmm. You got to pay your annual dues. Mm-hmm. And if you miss it, you're no longer fear-free.
Mm-hmm.
Really? I missed it by like a week. So no, I'm no longer a Fear Free clinic. Like AHA is like, we were AHA certified for years. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I never saw the benefit of AHA, mm-hmm. except it told you how to practice correctly. Mm-hmm. Like there's 1,000-page checklist you got to go through.
Right.
But finally I said, okay, does anyone have a problem if we still practice the AHA guidelines, but don't pay the $15K to do it?
Yeah.
You know, I never had one person in 25 years ever come in and say, I'm here because you're an AHA certified hospital.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, I think that's a lack of education on AHA's part to not get out the importance.
Yeah.
Because trust me, it is a great benefit to do what AHA says because you run at a certain standard.
Yeah.
That more than likely will not get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's just. So that's the problem I have with Fear Free. It's like, oh, be Fear Free. It's X amount of money. And I'm like,
yeah.
If we're really, truly doing this, why don't we teach us how to be Fear Free?
Yeah.
And then we can go from there. And then offer different packages from there.
Right.
But at least let's start it, you know. Right. But, yeah, I found that funny. I was just like, oh, this is just the AHA model all over again. Mm-hmm. So, have you ever had to have the conversation with a client that's like, you're absolutely being awful and I can no longer see you?
Oh, yeah. Had to fire clients.
Quick or slow?
You know, I think it depends. I think before COVID, we were dealing with a lot and we would put up with a lot. During and after COVID, bye, go somewhere else. Like, we don't have time for this. And we should have done that from the beginning, I think. I think we put up with a lot more abuse with the staff than we should.
You love the curbside?
I didn't mind it. It took a while to get used to it, but I didn't mind it just because the interactions were limited over the phone. It was kind of nice.
Because you're introverted.
Yeah.
The introverts loved it.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, and going back and thinking about it, I wonder if that's why you love surgery so much.
Mm. Yeah.
At first.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what triggered that anxiety about it.
I don't know. I think I just got more anxious about all the possibilities of things that could go wrong and which they can. And it just manifested in that way.
So that's called preservative cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea of rumination, which is what you're doing. You're going home and worrying.
Yeah.
And then guess what? You go to bed and the first thing you do when you wake up is like worry.
Yeah.
That's going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it really gets in the way of recovery.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was going to be part of my dissertation because I was going to look at the stress and then look at recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided just to stop at stress and throw a whole bunch of stuff looking into the stress point that I believe a lot of the research on burnout, compassion, fatigue, stress, I think they're good. But I think they don't have a lot of meat on their bones.
Mm.
So I'm trying to create something that I created, and then I'm hoping other veterinary scholars will go off of it. But I think the recovery piece is huge.
Yeah.
Is huge. I love the idea of yoga.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of gardening.
Mm-hmm.
I love the, see, for me, it was cooking. I got into cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Love cooking. I'm a foodie, as you can tell. But I also, I never saw working out, though, as a relief for me. Because I was a swimmer for so many years, I was like, I don't really want to go work out again, you know? But I loved all those things. I love going for walks with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I love going out and getting cocktails with my, you know, couples. I love poker nights with the guys.
Mm-hmm.
So you really got to find that
thing. What is it that works for you?
And with your anxiety, did it get worse when you would just go home and not work out?
Yeah, I think I needed a little bit more of the physical component. I think for me, the stress in my body would manifest in physical ways. And so being able to go for a long walk, do yoga, it allowed that to release. And it was easier for me to let go.
Yeah. What, if you could change one thing in veterinary medicine about mental health, what would it be?
Hmm. I think the expectations that are put on us by ourselves, by owners, by clinics, I really wish that those would be more realistic and attainable. And I think that being able to address those things and having mental health days, having clinic cultures, like those are all, it's all part of it. So I wish there was more of an emphasis on it in general. Sometimes it's just looked over.
The problem with practice, though, is that we don't have enough veterinarians to have those mental health days.
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah.
And I'm from the generation where you just buck up and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And now mental health, in my opinion, is so very important.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going to keep you going longer. So giving a veterinarian a day off now will reap rewards in the long run.
Right.
And that was very hard for me to see until I was able to remove myself and just be a doctor. Because when I sold the corporate, I lost my managerial hat. I lost my entrepreneur hat. I was just a doctor. And I finally got a chance to see what my associates were going through. And I cannot apologize enough. I cannot. If I was to open up a clinic again, I'd probably only be open 4 days a week. And I would, I don't want to say boutique-y, but I would be very specific about the type of clients I'd let in the door. You know, now, is that a model that will be, you know, allow me to drive a Lamborghini? Probably not. I'm happy with the Toyota.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee you I will have staff that will stay with me forever.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I won't have to deal with the staff turnover, the doctor turnover,
right.
the manager turnover, right. all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Last question.
Mm-hmm.
Describe to me your one stress-free day. What are you doing?
Stress-free day. Let's say waking up with the sound of birds around me, going for morning yoga, feeling energized, refreshed, going for a walk on the beach, grabbing coffee and breakfast, coming back home, reading, journaling, time to watercolor something, gardening, something that just brings me joy, spending time with my husband, being able to, you know, build our relationship and cook dinner together and just really grateful that having the gratitude for all the things that were given to me that day.
Do you ever sit back and think, holy shit, look what I've done?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one problem that I'll close on that. I think we should all sit back and think about all the things that we have done to get where we are.
Yeah.
I mean, you give yourself a pat on the back.
Yeah.
There's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know why veterinary medicine's, everyone's not doing veterinary medicine? Because it's not easy.
Yeah.
If it was easy, everyone would be doing it. And I think a lot of us need to start thinking that way.
Yeah.
And it might be better for everybody.
Absolutely.
Dr. Sarah, it was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'll have you again because I think your anxiety piece is something that a lot of people deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you so much for opening up about it.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's something that a lot of people have to deal with it in the profession. And either they're too embarrassed or they think it's, you know, a weakness.
Yeah. And I thought that way too. I thought no one else is feeling this way. It's just me. And I wish there were people around me who talked about it more.
Yeah. So. Find your voice.
Yeah.
Open to communication and believe in yourself.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
You got the education.
Mm-hmm.
You passed vet school. You passed national boards, just like everybody else did.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next time on Irreplaceable Truths.